Hi everyone, I'm Manny, and you're listening to Bayan Bayou with Manny. This 7-episode podcast on anti-Asian hate, being Cambodian, and COVID-19 gives voice to Khmer 1.5 and second generations who are championing change in a time of racial divide in America. These stories showcase their unique journey of struggles and successes to make a difference in a country in which they call home. Today, I am talking to Melinda Kutch. Melinda is a psychiatric social worker, an emergency mental health first responder, and a native of Long Beach, California. Long Beach is home to the largest and oldest Cambodian community in America. At least 20,000 Khmer people live there. Melinda's family was part of the third wave immigrants, which is also the last of Cambodian refugees admitted to the United States from 1980 to early 1990s. Hi, Melinda. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being available to talk to me today. I have to start off by saying that social work is near and dear to my heart. What made you get into social work in the first place?
I think it's a lot of kind of growing up where I did. Just being part of the community. It's interesting, like just kind of having that refugee experience and not really knowing that you're part of this refugee experience until like you go to college. And I think that that's when I really kind of solidify that this is what I wanted to do. When I was going to high school at Poly High School, I was a peer counselor. So I always knew I liked the helping field. I guess like when I went to college, I began to experience that, or I learned that my experience was pretty novel. It wasn't common, especially like once I'm around like other college students who are also Asian, but they didn't have quite that refugee experience. And I think learning about that made me really interested to like learn more and kind of delve in to see what these experiences are like. And that brought me into social work.
Your family refugee experience played a big role in you wanting to help others. Would you describe social work as your calling?
100%. Definitely. Yeah. I think it's kind of strange. Like, I think there are many times I tried to like explore other careers, but for some reason, I always kept like coming back to this field.
Wow. Well, 100% is pretty definite. You knew what you wanted and you went after it. So that's really cool. You currently worked for the Los Angeles County Department of Mental Health. As a licensed mental health clinician, you assist and support patients who battle depression, severe anxiety, psychotic or substance-related disorders. Describe to me what a day in your life looks like.
Absolutely. I think that like you feel it. It's kind of an emotional experience when you feel like the career that you're on is the career that you feel like was meant for you. So every day is different. That's what I love about it. Some days I'll be helping, anyone that's experiencing homelessness under bridges, next to riverbeds. Some days I'll be at a supermarket or a parking lot. But usually what happens is I'll just meet someone, kind of introduce myself and let them know that I'm here to help them and to support them, kind of a start of a relationship with them. And I think that, you know, when you kind of do this quote unquote right or correctly, it's you're meeting the person where they're at. You know, you don't go in there trying to save them or, you know, feel that you have, you know, all the skills and resources and they need to take it, but rather it's like, you know, you meet them, introduce yourself and see what is it that they're looking for. And maybe it's nothing that day. Maybe it's just a conversation. Maybe it's just a hello, but that's just what it is. It's human connection.
Yeah, it's the kind of human connection that is very much needed, especially during a pandemic. As you mentioned earlier, your work also includes homeless outreach. It seems that California's homelessness problems has been out of control for decades. A recent federal report reveals that there's about 160,000 homeless people in California, and COVID-19 has only made it worse. I want you to take us to the streets. What have you observed in the area that you serve? Are you seeing poverty, untreated mental health challenges, and/or substance abuse cases?
I think what's really cool about where I'm at is I get to serve Long Beach. So I do homeless outreach in Long Beach, and it's a very exciting, fulfilling experience for me because, you know, it's where I grew up. And there's just something so fulfilling about being able to go back and serve the neighborhood that raised you. So being where I'm at, like I sometimes outreach in like Cambodia Town, which is a quite interesting experience, just because there's only like 2 degrees of separation if you're like a Cambodian from Long Beach, you know? but we've had some really good success stories. In that area, we see a lot of mental illness, and it's compounded with a lot of substance use. I think that the largest issue that isn't quite addressed adequately would be substance use. In my opinion, it's because a lot of folks just kind of see substance use as like a moral failure, you know, that a person isn't strong enough to, you know, stop using drugs and whatnot, rather than seeing it as a disease, which I think is often the case, you know. Addiction is maybe because of a trauma someone endured, and, you know, it's kind of their way to self-medicate. And I just feel like we don't give them enough support around that.
Yeah. What kind of support do you think they would want or need?
Well, the thing with substance use, right, is that a person has to be ready to quit or to stop or get treatment. And it has to be like at that moment, you know, you kind of swoop in, like they let you know that they're ready to stop or go to rehab or whatever it is. And you have to be able to connect them right then and there. The difficult part is to get them connected to services right then and there is nearly impossible. For instance, there is a substance abuse facility in Long Beach where you have to call every single day. And that day they'll let you know if there's a bed available or not. And if you're someone experiencing homelessness, you know, first off, getting a phone or having access to a phone is difficult. And then having to call every single day, it's very difficult. So these are some of the challenges. I think that field in particular is very underfunded.
So even if they want help, the challenge in getting support is so built in the system that it's nearly impossible for them to get it. Okay. So who are these faces living on the streets? Are they men, women, children, whites, blacks, Asians? Who are these people?
I would say predominantly men, and at least in LA County, I see more people who are black and white. But I will say that as times are going on, you're seeing a lot more women on the streets, and you're seeing a lot more people of color on the streets. I mean, other than just black folks. There are Asian folks, but not too many. I think that a lot of their families tend to take them in and kind of try to care for them. We also do see a lot of like Latino folks as well.
Coming up, Melinda says humanity with the homeless communities starts at hello.
I think that, you know, one thing we often overlook is that folks who are experiencing homelessness, they've been through a lot, you know, whether it's while they're on the streets or before they were on the streets, a lot of trauma, a lot of heartbreak and heartache.
Yeah. On average, how many homeless people would you see living on the streets each day?
Depending on where we're going, I would say we see at least 30 to 40 folks a day.
That's a lot. When you're on the scene, what kind of resources do you provide?
So we provide street-based mental health treatment. I'm a part of a multidisciplinary team where we have a caseworker, a clinician such as myself, a nurse, and a nurse practitioner. Our nurse practitioner can go out to the field, assess the person for medication needs, and prescribe the medications and bring it to them directly. Same with our nurse, except she doesn't have prescription privileges. And for me, I can go out, do mental health assessments, and provide street-based therapy if that's what they need, which is my favorite part of the job.
Yeah. What makes therapy your favorite part of the job?
First off, there's like, you know, a huge need, right? I think that, you know, one thing we often overlook is that folks who are experiencing homelessness, they've been through a lot, you know, whether it's while they're on the streets or before they were on the streets, a lot of trauma, a lot of heartbreak and heartache. And I enjoy being able to go to where they're at and kind of help them process the things they've been through and get them back on their feet. And just kind of listen to their stories. And a lot of these folks really haven't had that opportunity to just have someone listen to them in a really like empathetic way. And I do enjoy kind of fulfilling that role for them.
That's awesome. What type of services do the homeless community normally ask for?
So if it's someone who is kind of recently homeless, like, you know, less than a year, I think they're more open to accepting services, whether it's mental health, whether it's homeless services, food, anything of that sort. But someone that's been homeless for even longer, like over a year, 5 years, 10 years, they've kind of perhaps are a bit more jaded about the whole process. I think that for them, they feel like they've tried before and they were let down by an agency or institution or a caseworker. And they just believe that, you know, it's all a lie. And that is difficult to work with those clients just because you're kind of have to like rebuild that trust. As you know, trust is very hard to rebuild at many times.
Yeah, you're right. Trust takes time. And it's hard to build, and it's very easy to destroy. In addition to being a social worker, you're also an emergency crisis mental health first responder. Who make these calls, and under what circumstances do they make these calls?
Yeah, so these calls come from anyone, from family members, community members, anyone that is witnessing someone going through a mental health crisis and has access to this hotline. They can make the request to evaluate someone for a mental health crisis.
When you get there, what steps do you take when you arrive on the scene or in somebody's home?
There are a lot of steps that we take even before we arrive. Like, we'll triage the call. We'll call whoever it is that put in the request and get more information. See if the person is, you know, a threat or has any weapons on them. Nowadays, we have to see if they have any COVID symptoms. That kind of thing, and see if they're available to be a part of this evaluation. And then we'll like give them an ETA of when we'll arrive. And it's always me and a partner, so we're never alone. Then we'll go, when we arrive at the scene, we call the requester and have them meet us out front, kind of introduce ourselves and kind of try to build a quick trusting working relationship there. And then usually the requester will take us to the individual that needs to be evaluated, introduce ourselves and why we're there, which is to see if they are a danger to themselves, a danger to others, or if they're gravely disabled. In that moment, is it a crisis? It's an urgent service. It's, for instance, maybe they're talking to themselves and they're having a lot of delusions and whatnot, but they're not, you know, going to harm themselves or harm someone else. In that case, you know, we wouldn't necessarily hospitalize them, which is kind of what we're going out there to assess, to see if they need to be hospitalized and then seen further by a psychiatrist. And in those instances where they don't need to be hospitalized, we provide a lot of psychoeducation and kind of let everyone know that, you know, it's not illegal to be mentally ill.
Speaking of mental illness, do you find that that's part of your role as well, which is to bring awareness on mental health issues to the household?
Yes, absolutely. Perhaps sometimes the most frustrating part. And I guess it can be a very difficult conversation to have with folks, right? Especially like family members, is that it's not so much about curing them, but helping them live with it, get the proper treatment so they can kind of navigate the world as we know it.
Right. Yeah, it's a tough topic. In our earlier conversation, you mentioned that the average age of those who you are responding to is quite young. You were saying maybe somewhere from 7 to 16 years old. What are some of the issues that require your immediate intervention? And do you see a correlation between the increase in mental health illness and COVID-19?
Yeah, I would definitely say with the younger folks, a lot of it is they're feeling suicidal. And it could be like due to bullying. It could be due to like feeling lonely or isolated or just misunderstood. I think at that age, a lot of folks are trying to figure out who they are and how they can or where they belong in society. And because of that, they feel kind of isolated in a sense when they don't know or feel like anyone understands, you know, who they are as a person. Especially with the younger population, it definitely increased during COVID. Just because, you know, you don't have like schools and you're not seeing your friends and, you know, you have Zoom meetings, but it's just very different. And even when you're not in school or like on Zoom school, like you can't go out and see your friends either. And that's kind of, you know, we're social beings. And when you're a child, you're even more social. Or you're used to seeing, you know, your friends all the time. So I definitely think there's a connection there.
Yeah, this new normal doesn't always feel so normal. What have you observed repeatedly in your role as a first responder?
You know, it's interesting. Sometimes we do get called in and, you know, when it's our team, which is a psychiatric mobile response team, when we're called in, it's me and another social worker. And there are a few cases where we'll go out, we'll assess someone to see if they're a danger to themselves or a danger to others. And we do feel that they are. The tough part is that they have to voluntarily get onto the ambulance gurney. And that can be a big struggle. We as social workers can't go hands-on and get them onto the gurney just because we don't have that kind of training. And if they're not willing to go on, the only option we have is to call law enforcement to help them comply. And that's been a big challenge lately, I think, perhaps with everything going on with, you know, with law enforcement, with, you know, the community and society. Law enforcement has been very hesitant to be hands-on with our folks. And so there have been a few instances where we just have to walk away, even though we have written a legal hold. And it's just a very unfortunate situation because at the end of the day, we're walking away from a family that is concerned about, you know, their relative or their child. And there's nothing that we can do, even though they meet criteria, you know, to be assessed further by psychiatrists.
Yeah, it sounds frustrating. When you're in this situation you just described, how does it make you feel?
It's a very, very terrible feeling. I feel helpless, you know, and especially being with the families or whoever it is that requested this. And usually it, for them, it comes from a place of concern, right? That they're concerned for their child, they're concerned for their, you know, sibling or relative. And they feel that at that moment, that person needs additional support and should be assessed further or be hospitalized. And when we go out there, we agree with them, right? Or in these instances, do all the paperwork, do all the legal part of things, and then nothing can be enforced. And then having to walk away is probably like the most heart-wrenching part of it. You know, like having to look at these family members and let them know, like, I agree with you. I agree with everything that you say. And I believe you that your, you know, your child or your relative needs help. But there's nothing that we can do.
Yeah, it is disheartening, particularly when you want to help, but you can't. Coming up, Melinda says she did not know she was poor until she learned that others got to buy whatever and whenever they wanted it.
So that's why, like, you know, when I went to college, and I learned that people have that all the time throughout the year. I was like, not just once a year, like anytime, like when you wanted things, you know, like that was mind blowing to me.
You work with low income people. What are some similarities do you see in your own experience as a daughter of refugee parents living in America?
It's so funny, okay, because I never knew that I grew up poor until you meet other people who didn't grow up poor, and you're like, dang, I've been poor this whole time. You know, like, I thought that good.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny now, but I'm sure it was not funny then, right?
Oh, that was difficult. And yeah, I mean, that was like college. I'm like, oh, like, for example, like, I grew up in a house with 13 people, like a 4-bed, 2-bath, you know, and I thought that was normal, right? Everyone just kind of, you know, everyone lived together. It's totally normal. Like, we could only shower, like, we showered out of a bucket, and we only had like one thing of hot water per person, just because hot water would run out, you know. So eventually people start to peel off, like, once they were able to kind of save up and buy their own place.
For how many years did you experience a full house like that?
I probably experienced that for maybe 8 years before people started to peel off. The majority of the time, there was always maybe at least 10 people.
Yeah. And what was it that triggered this revelation for you that, hey, you know, I am not that well off?
I think perhaps it's being around less Cambodian people. Yeah, because, like, I think, you know, when you live in Long Beach, like, every other person you know is Cambodian. And that experience is very, it's very similar, you know, like, multi-generational households, right? And just kind of the struggle. And then going to college and just being around non-Cambodian people, whether it's, like, Asian non-Cambodians, right? And just kind of seeing that, like, oh, they got to take showers from a shower head, you know? And even just, like, for them, like, being able to buy whatever they want. I think that's a big part, is, like, being able to buy what you wanted rather than, like, just what you need. Like, I remember back, like, as a kid, we would go shopping once a year, you know? And that one shopping experience was, like, I was just so excited for it. I would look forward to it every single year and, like, make a list throughout the year about, like, what kind of things I wanted to buy. And then when that day came, it was amazing, you know?
Yeah, I can only imagine that, how exciting that was, right? Because it was something that you look forward to. And when you go shopping, are they for school or something else?
It was always for school. So it would be like summer, like right before school started, that's when we would go shopping. And that was very exciting for me. So that's why, like, you know, when I went to college and I learned that people have that all the time throughout the year, I was like, not just once a year, like, anytime, like, when you wanted things, you know, like, that was mind-blowing to me.
I can't imagine what you were going through at that moment. I'm sure you experienced a big cultural shock living in America, and it's a country of plenty, and yet that was not the reality for you. Let's talk about your parents for a little bit. When they first came to America, what kind of work did they do to support you and your siblings?
They all started donut shops. All of them. My mom tells me all the time. She's like, oh yeah, I was a good donut maker.
This definitely feeds into the whole stigma of Cambodians and donut shops in Long Beach.
Yeah. And it's actually really, like, to me, it's very grounding to hear my mom tell me her stories, and my dad as well, you know? Like, my mom tells me all the time how when they worked at the donut shops, they weren't making much, but they had to figure out a way to survive. And they would eat, like, Jack-in-the-Box Superstars or Famous Star burgers for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, because it was, like, 2 for $1 or something. And it was just so cheap, you know, and it, you know, fed them. And I think about that a lot, like, these small little sacrifices they had to make.
Yeah. Speaking of sacrifice, I remember you telling me that your grandparents raised you because your mom and dad were always working. Is that typical for Cambodians living in Long Beach?
I would say it's very typical. If you know, you were blessed enough to have grandparents, you know, like, I know that there's a lot of folks who, like, their grandparents didn't survive. And so, like, you know, mom had to stay home and not work so that she could take care of the kids. And then you have a one income household. So in that regard, I do think that, like, my family was more well off just because we had that kind of support, of the grandparents watching the kids. Yeah, I definitely had a lot of friends in high school who didn't have that kind of luxury, you know, that one of the parents had to stay home and one had to work. And I know that made their lives a lot more difficult.
Yeah, I think it's a matter of being grateful with what you have, and it's a matter of perspective, right? Let's talk about race and racism. Did you experience racism growing up in America? And if you did, what about it that had the most impact on you?
Like, we lived in a predominantly Black and Latino neighborhood. So we grew up in North Long Beach, right there at the border of Compton. And I never really quite understood, you know, what racism was, right? You know, it's not something that is really taught to you. But I remember many times as a kid that, you know, people would, like, throw things through our living room window and shatter it. And this happened quite a few times. It would just be in the middle of the night and it would scare us. And at the time, I just thought that, like, maybe it was just, they just had something against, you know, this house, or, you know, I didn't think that it was intentional until I began to see, like, the way, like, as I got older and see how we were treated different than other people on the block. Then I began to realize, like, maybe it is in the way that we look.
Yeah, you were probably too young to really understand what was going on. Let's talk about the Cambodian community for a little bit. You are really insulated within the Cambodian community in Long Beach and its way of life. What are some of the pros and cons of being so exclusive to one's culture?
I love my culture. I love it so much. And I will say that I didn't really know that I loved it so much until I went to college, right? and I bring that up a lot, right? How college really changed me, because I began to really feel the weight of my culture. That was probably the first time that I realized that there was a bigger world outside of Long Beach, you know? And I feel like my culture has grounded me more than anything, especially as I am trying to navigate this professional world and try to, like, really carve out a place for me professionally. More than anything, having my culture has kept me grounded in my values. You know, that it is not just about me, but it is about my community. It's about my family. It's about us as a collective. And that's what I love about, I guess, you know, Cambodian culture, about Asian culture, about the culture that, you know, we come from.
Absolutely. For the Khmer community, it's about the family, the children, the grandparents. It's about togetherness, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And family is not just, you know, blood. It's community.
That's a really good point, Melinda, you just made, because family is not just about your own nuclear family. You know, it's about your community. It's about society. It's about something that's bigger than yourself. And what are some of the cons, if there's any, in being so exclusive to one's culture?
Like I say, like, 2 degrees of separation in Long Beach. Like, everyone knows each other's business.
Yeah, we can be a little bit gossipy. I would have to agree with that.
Yes, lots of gossiping, and I feel it in my blood. I hate that. I love to gossip. It's quite a con. You know, it's kind of like when you're too close to someone or to a community. When some, like, a small thing or a small issue arises, it can feel like something very large.
Yeah, I could see that happening. Coming up, Melinda says empathy is key to changing the stigma of mental health needs.
It's about changing the language. Instead of saying, hey, do you want mental health services? It's, hey, do you want someone to talk to? Like, hey, it seems like you're going through something very difficult. I'm here to kind of listen if you'd like.
Let's talk about the American dream, because we all believe in this, that if you work hard, you will reap the reward. Do you believe in the American dream? And do you think this is a reality for your family and the Cambodian communities living in Long Beach?
Ooh, that is a great question. And I think it is a multi-layered and very complex question. I think that hard work will always get you somewhere. That I will say without a doubt. But the caveat is that we are living in very complex and very oppressive systems. And I think that unless you are given kind of the direction on how to navigate it, it can be very difficult to rise up, right? Especially as Cambodians. If you don't have that kind of mentorship from someone that is familiar with how it works, how the American dream works, it can be difficult on how to actually achieve it, given the kind of, you know, society that we live in where, you know, people of color aren't exactly appreciated when they do kind of gain power or money or influence. And I see that with, like, you know, me and my brothers, right? Like, my brothers and I, we grew up the exact same ways, same neighborhood, same upbringing, all of that. However, I'm the only one that has gone to college, you know, that has a career. And it's like, well, if the American dream was attainable, then why is it just me? Because I know that my brothers worked just as hard. I do know that for them, school didn't come as easy for them, right? And that's something to think about, right? Why? What is it about school that was more difficult for them? Is it because school is, you know, was it structured in a way that only benefits some students and not others? And I think that these systems need to be looked at, and that, like, if you really want to believe that the American dream is attainable for all.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's a nice concept, but it's not for everybody, right? These are really good points that you just brought up, because as we know, dreams and reality are not always aligned. Let's go back a bit to our earlier conversation. You mentioned a bubble, this bubble within the Cambodian community in Long Beach. Can you elaborate on that?
First, you know, growing up in Long Beach as a Cambodian, everyone kind of has that same experience as you, you know, where, like, your family more or less are refugees. They came here in the 80s and they came here with nothing. So you're kind of used to living in, like, multi-generational households. Like, a majority of Asians in your life are Cambodian. You know their families, or someone that you know knows them. And it's just very, it's just like this common feeling, you know, that everyone is just struggling to make it, basically. And it's kind of comforting in that sense. It's a bubble. You just feel like this is what it is. This is life. And I feel like you don't really realize that you're in a bubble until you kind of venture off out of it. I think the main thing is, like, wealth. Like, I didn't know that there was, like, I didn't know what real wealth was until I ventured outside this bubble.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Let's touch on wealth and success for a bit. Asians, as you know, are often described as the model minority in America. It implies that we are successful due to our upbringings that value education and hard work. Is that the reality for the community in Long Beach? Are Cambodians part of the model minority myth, or is it simply a stereotype that is not reflective of the Asians' experience?
Yeah, it's definitely not reflective. And especially for Cambodians, you know, I think that if you look at the data of, like, how they do in school, how they perform, you know, professionally or in the careers, you see that they are falling behind in terms of the other Asian ethnicities. That's the difficulty, right? When you put all the numbers together, right? Like, you lump in all the Asians together, you overlook, you know, perhaps the Asian ethnicities that really need the help and support, right? Because not all Asians, you know, are refugees or come from refugee families. In fact, many of the Asians that are here that are non-Cambodian are self-selecting, right? Like, they had the means and incomes and were able to plan out a life in America, as opposed to, you know, many or most Southeast Asians that were kind of forced from their countries and came to America with nothing. And when you lump in that data together, you know, you don't see the true picture.
Yeah, it's definitely a generalization, right? When it's compiled all together and blended like that.
Yeah, I definitely appreciate you kind of having this conversation with me and kind of bringing awareness to what it's like to be, you know, a Cambodian American and to kind of navigate this world that we deeply feel was not built for us. And, you know, for me, like, I more than anything want to help bring people out of that and kind of let them know that, you know, you are in a bubble. Not that it's a bad thing. Sometimes it's comforting to stay in the bubble, but kind of let folks know it's not your only option.
Yeah. It's like comfort food. It tastes good. It tastes like home, but maybe it's not always good for you. And maybe it's good to venture out for a little bit and see where that takes you. Let's talk about social work, Melinda. Social work, as you know, is underpaid and underappreciated. You have been doing this for more than 7 years now. To me, you are very positive and upbeat and very optimistic, but I'm sure you get stressed out as well. How do you cope with stress and do you get burned out?
Yeah, I mean, it can definitely be difficult. I feel like it helps that this is a profession of love for me. You know, this is my heart and my soul, and it doesn't really burn me out because I feel like I'm, you know, going towards my calling. But when I do have those moments where, like, it's difficult, I'm very lucky to have a very supportive family. You know, like, my siblings and relatives I grew up with, you know, it was us five. We are still very, very close. And in those moments where I feel like I feel far removed from my roots, I go and hang out with my cousin and she grounds me. You know, she tells me, like, don't you forget where you came from. And that keeps me grounded and keeps me going.
Yeah, it's great to have a support system. What's next for you? Is this your forever profession?
This is my forever profession. Yeah, for sure. Even if I won the lotto tomorrow and was a billionaire, I'd still be doing it.
We will see, because this conversation is recorded. So I'm going to send this to you when you win that lottery and become a billionaire.
Right. I mean, I do think that what I would love to do, and it's kind of my next year goal, is to open up my own private practice. And I would love to work with, like, children of immigrants and refugees. Just to kind of provide, like, mentorship and direction and kind of help them process what it's like to have these kind of dual identities. That is my next goal.
That's a wonderful goal, and I hope you reach your endeavors, because growing up, I would benefit so much if I had mentors and a roadmap and a system to help me get over all the bumps. Let's talk about therapy. As a social worker, your work involves providing therapy. But in my understanding, the Cambodian community is not very inclined to talk about their feelings or their emotional challenges. How do you make therapy a tool that is useful for Cambodians? And how do we start this conversation?
Right. I think the tough part is it's all in the language, right? First off, a lot of mental health terms doesn't exist in the Khmer language. But what I've realized, just perhaps, like, outside of the Cambodian community, like, for folks who are resistant to, like, quote unquote, like, mental health, it's about changing the language. Instead of saying, hey, do you want mental health services? It's, hey, do you want someone to talk to? Like, hey, it seems like you're going through something very difficult. I'm here to kind of listen if you'd like, rather than, like, I'm here to offer you mental health services.
What I'm hearing you say is that we need to reframe the language. We need to say, hey, I'm here for you and I want to listen, instead of saying you have a problem and so let me fix it for you. Is that what you're saying?
I believe so. I think that we'll probably have to start on a very small, like, one-on-one basis. And as you know, in, like, Cambodian or Asian communities, it's word of mouth is how things spread, right? So if you help one person, you know, in that kind of, like, very casual way, just someone to talk to, and then they might go up to their friends like, hey, yeah, I have this person I talked to and, you know, it's been going really well. And then they're like, oh, well, let me go find someone to talk to. And then, you know, it kind of spreads that way. that in that regard, I'm kind of optimistic. Perhaps it can work that way.
Last question. What do you love most about the Cambodian community in Long Beach?
I love this community. I love it for the culture. I love it for the way that they care for each other and watch out for each other. And more than anything, how they want more for each other. I think it's a beautiful thing, and I really hope that, you know, we as a community hold on to that and that we stay together and not, you know, tear each other down or anything like that. That, you know, our culture is beautiful and we just gotta stick together.
I love that. That is a very beautiful message, Melinda. Thank you.
And here's my conclusion. I really admire your passion and your tenacity to serve the underprivileged and the marginalized communities. My takeaway from our conversation today is that you are the role model that I aspired to be when I was growing up. You are a proud Cambodian, and it shows. Thank you so much, Melinda, for sharing your story.
Thanks for tuning in. I hope you enjoy listening to my guest journey from surviving to thriving as Khmer in America, and for the lessons they have learned and shared with us. For more stories like this, visit us at voacambodia.com. Until next time, I'm Manny, your host of Bayan Bayou with Manny.